And we're going to open the Senate Committee on Education, and we're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 440. Senator Farioli, thank you for being here. Do you want to give a short explanation of our bill before he gets to start?
And I'll pay close attention to the explanation of this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Chair Roble, members of the committee. Senate Bill 440 directs the Oregon Department of Education to consult with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to prepare an annual list of high-wage and high-demand jobs in the state, the projected need for those jobs, the projected salary for those jobs, the training programs or college programs that can lead to those jobs, and the projected costs associated with said training or college programs. The bill requires ODE to distribute the list to school districts and award grants to districts to ensure that the list is distributed to students in grades 9 through 12. The bill appropriates $5 million to ODE for the purpose of funding this bill. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017. The -1 amendment removes the emergency clause. It removes the requirement for ODE to consult with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and adds a requirement for ODE to consult with the Employment Department. The amendment adds an effective date 91 days after the 2017 legislative session adjourns sine die.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ted Farioli, District 30. Thank you for allowing a hearing on Senate Bill 440. As you heard, the bill does a number of things that we believe are necessary to let folks in the educational system, students, to help them find opportunity, to help them not only find opportunity but target specific career areas where they may find an opportunity that perhaps they're not aware of. We looked hard to find organizations that had a nexus to these issues, and what we discovered was that the Employment Department and the State Workforce Investment Board have collaborated to put out some studies and a similar report on this issue. What's necessary is to connect the students with the information, and that's the purpose, broadly, in broad terms, that's the purpose of the $5 million appropriation. We are looking at the idea that students accrue, they invest a lot in their own education, they borrow a lot of money. I think many of you today have had the opportunity to meet with the dental students. If you weren't shocked by the amount of money that a dental student will invest in an education, you should be. We heard stories today of $300,000 to $400,000 for a professional degree. Those are at the higher level of cost and the higher level of potential proficiency, but even the average is getting to $27,000 to $30,000. Per student in terms of debt. In order to carry that debt, in order to have opportunity, students certainly need to be looking at tailoring their education to places where opportunity exists. So this is a mechanism to connect people's educational aspirations with real jobs in real time that are available here in Oregon. We think helping them make those decisions and helping them target will really provide a long-term benefit both for those students and for Oregonians. And that's the purpose of Senate Bill 440.
Any questions for Senator Farioli? Just a comment. My father was a high school teacher. Before that, he was a carpenter, and he was the union, Carpenters Union secretary and apprenticeship trainer. And they always had a list of where carpenters were needed all over the country. So when he taught his kids, he'd say, you may not get to work here in Port Angeles, Washington, but if you're willing to go to Texas, if you're willing to go to Colorado, if you're willing to go to these people, we know where you can get a job.
Right.
And it really did help those people make decisions about what they were going to do with their education, where they were going to go. So I the concept of figuring out how to integrate it in a way that high school kids will really use that information to better further their choices is going to be a challenge, but I think without it, it's impossible. So
well, I think, Mr. Chair, in the case of your father, also for kids to get out of the rainforest that was Port Angeles.
Exactly. Though the ones that stayed became millionaires. All I can say is they did okay building houses and stuff there, too.
So Squim.
Squim?
Yes.
That's where my wife's from. So she always complained about no rain.
You have a -1 amendment, which...
Yep.
does remove the emergency clause. We don't think that there's an emergency here. We just think there's a really good policy here. And it changes BOLI out and adds the Employment Department and the State Workforce Investment Board as partners. And if you haven't, the list of occupations that are in high demand in Oregon, which is a perhaps an improvement on knowing there's jobs in the oil fields in the Midwest, that's great. But knowing where the high-wage, high-skilled jobs are available in Oregon probably helps us keep the best and brightest from having to leave the state.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We had no one else that wished to testify, but after hearing the thrilling testimony, is there anyone out there now who can't resist coming up and speaking?
Yeah, I was standing up.
Okay, thank you. We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 440. We're going to open public hearing on Senate Bills 351 and 354, because we have people that want to talk to both of them. And so we'll open that one, and Senator Frederick, come on up. So we have a bunch of people here for different bills, because we have a lot of bills. Hopefully they're going to be entertained by the information that we get to have today, and by the exceptional Senate speakers.
Oh, gracious. Well, first of all, I think we need to say happy National Pie Day. Just wanted to
It's right there. I was going to say that, actually.
You didn't start it off that way.
I know.
Math teacher does not start off with pie.
For those people that don't know, it's 314 today, which is 3.14, for those non-math people who don't necessarily love pie like some of us do.
Or as somebody else said, National E-Day, but that's another story.
That's another story.
Thank you, Senator Roblin and members of the committee. I guess that sort of shows my nerdish state there, and that's fine. I'm Senator Lou Frederick, representing Senate District 22 North and Northeast Portland. Now, what I've found in my short time in the Senate is that my colleagues tend to look for solutions after having already identified and evaluated the problems we're trying to solve here. 2 years ago, we passed House Bill 2713. It called for an audit of the Smarter Balance Test and other summative assessments. In September, Secretary of State Jean Atkins and her team produced an excellent report that I see as the first step in a process to question the value and cost of the SBAC as it refers to the effectiveness of Oregon students. How we respond to the audit and the impact of the tests is what Senate Bill 351 will assess. But first, let me return to comments I made last year for context. If you're growing tomatoes, you want a good outcome, but it's not magic. It doesn't happen because you keep measuring the plants. In fact, you can have indications of your outcomes are going to be good all along the way and then find out at the end of the summer that you've grown huge plants with no tomatoes. That's because your inputs weren't the right ones for producing fruit. Tomatoes need light, warmth, fertilizer, and water for good outcomes. And growing children need stimulation, wonder, and excitement, as well as educational content for good outcomes. If we don't focus on high-quality inputs, we're going to be disappointed with our outcomes, no matter what those test scores might look like. I won't go over the reasons for skepticism about the SBAC and the over-reliance on narrow summative testing. I suggest that you and others might read page 18 of the report by the Secretary of State's office. There are several recommendations that I do want to point out, five of them. The first one, clarify the purpose of the statewide summative assessments. Number two, provide additional information to the public regarding the development, content, validation, and scoring of the Smarter Balanced assessment. Number three, provide additional reliance on the use of test results to districts and schools. Number four, consider opportunities to expand the use of formative and interim assessments and or de-emphasize the focus on summative assessments. And number five, streamline and improve test administration guidance, especially related to accessibility resources and scheduling. It is not a matter of limited communication or selling the SBAC to students or to parents. There are serious flaws in the tests, in my view. Serious flaws in the testing culture in the schools and in the use of those tests. We have not provided a reason for students and parents to want to take the tests, beyond the need for statistics to track how well they might compare with other students. What are the students learning? Are they learning that the main goal of the school is to take tests? When do students, parents, and teachers find out about the scores? Do the scores mean anything to the people taking the test, administering the test? Not according to teachers and parents that I encounter. I've met a few and only a handful of teachers who are also parents who find that the tests provide any real value to the learning experiences of their own children. I continue to hear at my town halls and in the grocery store aisles of my very informal Fred Meyer Safeway New Seasons office that the cost of the tests, pretests, SBAC class projects, and the cost of computers take away from the classroom materials that students need for a much more comprehensive education. More concerns are being raised about how much time is taken away from science investigations, engaging history projects, hands-on civic studies, art and music programs, and interesting literature classes. It is mentioned in the report as well, but it begs repeating. Many schools basically shut down their libraries and computer rooms starting about now, going into late May, to accommodate the test schedule. That takes away time and opportunity from students that may be difficult to quantify in dollars, but it's certainly an obvious loss in time. Once again, I applaud the Secretary of State's office. I am asking that we continue the investigation already underway and determine the financial and opportunity costs of the SBAC. Carefully consider any effort to bring more testing into the system and take a more critical look at the value of the tests to determine if they're helping students learning versus providing just a baseline of data for the sake of comparison. Now, regarding SB 354, I believe it is simply a request that calls for parents to avoid either a sales marketing approach to the question of SBAC. Just the facts, ma'am, is what I think we should be dealing with. SB 354 prevents the use of language that is a veiled threat to the student's school should a parent opt out of the SBAC test because they find no value in the time taken to take the test or the time taken away from the comprehensive education they want for their children. And I'm going to end it with a quote from the National Task Force on Assessment Education report that was titled ESSA, E-S-S-A, and the Assessment Literacy, Serving the Education Ecosystem. When students understand the purpose of assessments and can interpret the results, they become partners in meeting their learning goals and can use more than just traditional assessment to demonstrate their learning. As a result, students become more engaged in their learning. That's what I want. I think that's what we all want, is to make sure that we actually have students engaged and involved in their learning. I think that the overemphasis on the testing that we've seen not just in Oregon, but across the country, has taken that away. And in fact, as a third grader put it to me, when I grow up, will I just be taking tests all the time? That's the kind of thing we want to avoid. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator? Yes. We'll start with Senator Cruz.
A couple comments. Senator Frederick and I have had conversations about this for several years now. And I do think what Secretary of State did was a good first step. And I told the senator that I'm meeting relatively soon with Secretary of State to try to figure out what the next step as far as Secretary of State's audits should be in this process. And I do agree that we need to look at whether it's even cost effective to do what we're doing or whether we should be looking in another direction. And quite honestly, what I'm wanting to do is to find out if indeed the requirements from the federal government for all this testing based on this little chunk of money they give us, if it actually costs our school districts more to comply with the federal regs than the feds are giving us, and if that's the case, maybe we should be looking at going in a different direction. So hopefully we can get some answers to this and you know, we did a bill on backpacks, okay? And I'm trying to think why kids are taking so much homework home, and maybe part of the reason is they're spending so much time in the class doing all of this testing and preparing for the test that they have to do homework to do the real work that they should be doing in the classroom. That could be a possibility. I think that education is better if we're in control of it rather than being told what to do by somebody in Washington, D.C. And so I'm hoping we can get some answers, and I'll be more than happy to work with you to see if we need to do some modifications to make sure we're getting at the points that both you and I want to get at.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I would push back against the third grader. I will push back against you because I've known you for so long.
It won't be the first time.
The question was, will I have to take tests all my life? I think I would say yes. It starts when that third grader becomes 16 and has to go take a driver's test. And then it continues when you go into college. And there are tests in college, a lot of them. When you get out of college, if you want to become a lawyer, you have to take a bar exam. That's a big test. It takes all day. Boards for doctors, people in healthcare, financial consultants have to take a series of tests all of their life. So tests are part of life. It is how you measure competence. It is just a measurement device. I don't understand why we can't make these tests more user-friendly. I'm very much supportive of that. But it doesn't have to be either or. We should make them easier and not such a burden on schools and students and parents. But by removing them altogether, I don't think is the solution either. And by the system that we've gone to, it seems like the students who are opting out come from some of the more affluent families in the system, which, you know, creates unintended problems that I don't think either of us want.
Well, Senator Roebland, Senator Hess, I appreciate your comments. I can agree with you. First of all, I'm not suggesting that we get rid of tests. Okay, you have to do that. You have to find out how students are doing. I do question the value of these particular tests and the way that they have been put together. And more importantly, when you take a test when you take a driver's test, you know where you failed. You understand directly what's taken place. You don't wait 6 months to find out, or 4 months to find out. And when you're working with students, you want to find out what their issues are right away so that you can begin to work with them. That's not what's really taking place here. Let me make sure that people understand. I'm not saying get rid of tests. That's not the point here. I've questioned the value of this particular set of tests and the way it has been instituted, as well as the incredible amount of time and money that we're spending on the tests, the pre-tests, the other programs that we're dealing with. That's the point for the third grader, is that he was getting tested all the time and didn't find out what he was doing. Did he understand fractions? That wasn't part of it. What was happening was he was getting tested on fractions, and the information was sent, and they said, all these third graders have this issue regarding fractions, not that particular individual student. We need to understand what the tests are supposed to be doing, and I appreciate that. Regarding the opt-out, I think it's a mistake to believe that it is simply the higher-income, wealthy kids who are opting out. That's not the case. Certainly not the case around the country. In Seattle, it was almost all of the 11th grade class in Seattle, which was not a high-income group. They were opting out because they, again, did not feel as though what was happening with the testing was helping them. It was instead being used as primarily a tool for statistical data, not for giving them information about what they needed to learn. So that's the issue that I'm trying to get at here. Is how do in terms of the opting out, I think parents need to be able to understand what it is, what's happening there, and why they need to take the test, and the kids need to understand that as well. And at this point, we don't have those answers well. It's not just a matter of communication; it's a matter of really having people understand what is needed and how we learn.
Well, just if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, if we both agree that we need to make these tests better, more relevant, easier on everybody, more responsive, then let's do that. Mm-hmm. But in fact, an opt-out is getting rid of tests. It's saying we're not going to do it. And what that does is it waters down the outcomes of the other tests, because now you've got less science to work from. If you've got 10 or 20% of the kids, you don't have a good collective pool on which to judge how this class is performing in science or math or whatever it is. And so that is a complete shutdown.
Well, except that you can, excuse me, Senator. I understand what you're saying, but let me just say, except that you don't have to take, you can get that information without having everyone take the test. You can get that information by way of formative tests, not summative tests. You can get that information in a lot of different ways. And we have what has happened is we have been sold on the idea that this is a, that the summative tests are the way to only the only way to get that information. That's not true. And so that's and I really am concerned about the testing itself, but the overuse of it. Again, the problem that has happened is you when you have teachers and principals and superintendents being told that the way that they're going to be judged is on these tests, they spend their time on those tests. They don't spend their time with an looking at a science experiment or doing something in terms of a civics class. They spend their time on this. So you get those tests end up being the first thing that people think about. That's something we've got to change. I think that if we the idea is to increase the audit idea and look and see how much are we actually spending that's going to be effective. That's the approach that I'm taking on that.
Okay. And
if
you have data on the outcomes that it's just not well-to-do families or then I'll stand corrected. But from what I've seen is the percentage from Lincoln High School, for example, of students that opt out is higher than Aloha in my district. And so that's where I drew those conclusions. If you have something that contradicts that, to me it does feel like the students who have more resources at home and more connected parents, those are the kids that are more likely to opt out than kids in lower socioeconomic runs.
That may be true in one way, but let me put it another way. The initial letter that the Department of Education put out regarding allowing people to opt out of tests was threatening, was condescending at best, and people went through and marked out things. They were, when they handed it in, they were told by their schools, you can't do this. And for the parents at Lincoln High School, they don't put up with that. For the parents at a lower income school, they go, well, I guess I better do this. There's a difference in terms of just the message and the general culture that says I'm going to go along with this because I don't want to be this authority figure is telling me I've got to do this. That's part of the difference in terms of the numbers opting out in my experience, when as well as other folks not knowing what it is they could do.
Senator Lipscomb.
Just an overall comment. In the Secretary of State's audit report, the recommendations and the comments you're making hold throughout this audit. You know, the amount of monies are illustrated on page 4 of the audit, where it describes all of the agencies that received millions and millions of dollars performing this test. The question at the end of the day is, what did Oregon get out of it? Where did those results go, and what do they prove to us? And if those affluent kids are opting out, I would echo, that's good, because what we want to see is we want to see how our schools are performing, not with all of the influx of high scores from individuals who don't need to be part of the assessment, but we want to really weigh how is our school weighing the kids who are there in the public school system, not those who may be opting out on the high side one way or the other. So I think it's appropriate to look at how can Oregon spend these monies and get bang for their buck. We want a return on our investment.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Let me put it another way, another direction. The private schools that I know don't use this. The high performing private schools in the United States and certainly in Oregon do not run their kids through SBAC. They don't use it as a tool to determine how well their students are doing. That tells me something about the credibility of the program. So that's part of my concern as well.
Okay. Any further questions? thank you very much for being
thank
here. And I know
much.
You have a committee that's going on, so I'll let you
I
go.
I do.
And
thank
we
you.
We have some people. So next we're going to call up Sharon. Sharon? Bless. How do I say the last name?
Blasey.
Blasey. Okay. It was like it should have been. Come on up. And Caroline? Oh, there's it is. Oh, there's three of you. Come on up, all three.
Thank you.
How about?
And Jan.
Jan and, okay, that's good for now. Is there a Mary fan? Is she wants, do you want to be a part of this group? We can bring a fourth chair. Okay, perfect. Whoever wants to start.
So good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Blasey, and I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division. Joining me to present is Caroline Zavikowski, who led this audit. We are presenting a high-level overview of the audit released last year, which was in response to House Bill 2713 from 2015. That bill is very similar to Senate Bill 351, which is before you today. The purpose was to conduct an audit related to the use in public schools of Oregon of the statewide summative assessment developed by a multi-state consortium. We focused the audit on the impacts of smarter balanced assessment on Oregon public schools and made recommendations for improving the statewide summative assessment process. We did not audit the content of the assessment. Smarter balanced is tied to the Common Core state standards and was implemented in Oregon in 2015. Audit work was conducted during the spring of 2016 during the Smarter Balance testing window. As a result, most of the information we gathered was regarding the first year of the Smarter Balance testing during the 2014-15 school year, with some information from the second year. The Smarter Balance test is Oregon's summative or end-of-year statewide test in math, English, and language arts. The purpose of this type of test is to provide a measure of accountability, data to identify achievement gaps, and information about whether students meet standards overall. We gathered information about impacts of the test through focused interviews, visits at six public schools, and multiple surveys. We interviewed over 100 people, including Department of Education staff, district and school personnel, leadership from the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, leadership from the education experts, and a variety of stakeholders, including groups representing school boards, administrators, educators, parents, families experiencing disability, and communities of color, among others. The schools we visited were selected to obtain a diverse representation in terms of geography, student population, grade levels, test preparation, poverty level, and preparation for adopting Common Core state standards. While visiting the schools, we met with teachers, principals, students, and test coordinators. The surveys were distributed to principals, teachers, parents, and school district administrators. We invited the Oregon Parent Teacher Association to distribute a link to the parent survey through their listserv on their Facebook page. In total, we received over 6,000 survey responses. We received about 400 responses to the principal survey, a 31% response rate. We received administrator responses from 95 out of the 197 school districts, or about 48%. We received just over 5,000 responses to the teacher survey and 800 responses to the parent survey. The information that we gathered regarding impacts on budget and staff time was anecdotal and self-reported. We did not examine school budgets or educator timekeeping because it would have been difficult to determine which expenses would be directly attributed to statewide summative assessments, and because we did not want to add additional work during that time to teachers and administrators by asking them to begin tracking something they were not already tracking.
For the record, my name is Caroline Zavikowski. Through the information gathered in site visits, surveys, and interviews, we heard mixed opinions of the new test, including many concerns about challenges with administration in the first year. Teachers described how the test took time away from classroom instruction, including the time they spent preparing students to take the test. We heard about the demands the test can place on staffing, including losing support services while those staff members administer the test. Some school and district administrators reported hiring additional staff or substitutes specifically for testing. In many places, computers were unavailable to classes that were not testing during the last several weeks or months of the year. While many Oregon schools had to make adjustments, some educators also said the impact was no different from the previous test. We heard that in some schools there were improvements with test administration in the second year. Some also appreciated having a test tied to standards that are more rigorous. District and school priorities, preparation, and resources varied prior to test administration. Some schools had adequate technology prior to the introduction of Smarter Balance. And we heard from some educators that having at least one computer for every student was helpful for testing logistics. District implementation of Common Core aligned curriculum prior to the new test also varied. State expenditures for state standardized testing contracts increased in the transition year to Smarter Balance. Contract costs to support most standardized tests rose $5 million between the 2013-14 school year and the 2014-15 school year. Some of this increase can be attributed to costs associated with hand scoring the written portions of the Smarter Balanced assessment. We also found that there was not clear agreement on the test purpose. Some we spoke to focused on the test as a measure of how individual students are performing, and other focused on it as a gauge of systems-level goals, such as school accountability and addressing achievement gaps. The Department of Education could take a more active role in communicating about the test purpose. We learned that schools and districts are not using test results consistently. Superintendents and principals who answered our survey said that faster results would help them make decisions for the following school year. Many also reported that additional guidance on how to use results would be useful. The Department of Education reported that results were available to school districts more quickly in the second year than in the first. In the department's response letter to our audit, they said that the 2015-16 school year, quote, most test results were scored and returned to school districts no later than 14 days from the time a test was completed, with many scores returning within a matter of days, end quote. Though we would like to point out that the department was referring to unofficial scores, the official scores were not released until September of 2016. There is also concern about the focus on Smarter Balance as a summative or end-of-year assessment. We heard from educators and parents who felt that end-of-year standardized testing received too much emphasis, both in terms of time and in pressure on students and teachers to do well. Some felt that there are not clear benefits for students and teachers most affected by testing, because the results of summative tests are not well suited to inform individual instruction. We heard that a more comprehensive assessment system could be useful. Additional resources for mid-year and classroom assessment that can inform individual instruction could help students and support teachers. These could include things like chapter tests, midterms, quizzes, and class activities. Some educators were also concerned that certain student populations may experience more negative impacts than others while preparing for and taking the test. Despite providing accommodations, the test's greater use of technology and emphasis on written responses may increase the risk that some students may not be able to demonstrate their abilities accurately. Students in special education, English language learners, and students with less exposure to technology and typing may be particularly affected. Students are given as much time as they need to complete the test, but those who take longer can miss more instruction time.
Okay. So we made the following recommendations to the Department of Education. Clarify the purpose of the statewide summative assessments. Identify and expand communication efforts that have been successful. Provide additional information to the public regarding the development, content, validation, and scoring of Smarter Balanced assessment. Provide additional guidance on the use of test results to districts and schools. Continue to work with the testing vendor to provide results in a more timely manner. Continue to identify and expand opportunities to use summative assessment data in conjunction with other data sources for systems improvement. Consider opportunities to expand the use of formative and interim assessments and/or de-emphasize the focus on summative assessments. Continue to work with the American Institute for Research and the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium to address technical issues such as computers freezing and accommodations not working properly. Streamline and improve test administration guidance, especially related to accessibility, resources, and scheduling. Formalize mechanisms for school-level educators to provide feedback that can improve future testing. Facilitate sharing of best practices by encouraging regional sharing and highlighting examples. Continue to identify and incorporate opportunities to reduce individual impacts in collaboration with the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium. And then just lastly, I would say we're scheduled to follow up with the Department of Ed officially later this year, but they are here today to share the current status of our recommendations.
So we'll go to Jan.
Chair Roble, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, the Legislative Director for the Department of Education, here to give you a status update. The quick version is that the Secretary of State had 12 recommendations. We've either completed all of what they've recommended or in the process of completing them. Some of them are ongoing. We want to thank them for their audit. It was, I thought, well done, very thorough. And as this committee knows, the landscaping has really changed in terms of assessment now with the new federal law. And the department has a lot more latitude in what it can do with the assessment. And I think Deputy Superintendent Noor was testifying that we're looking especially at the high school assessment to see if we can make that more relevant to students and more useful to teachers, and looking at other vendors for that. In terms of the length of the test, we are working with SBAC and the company that actually delivers the assessment to decrease the testing time. In terms of test score turnaround time, we're working on shortening that. As Secretary of State mentioned, most of the time we can get some sort of score back to the schools within 14 days, and we're still looking at, you know, what is slowing things up for some of the other scores, what's happening either at a state level or at a local level. And regarding the clarification of what is the purpose of the assessment, we've gone through all our training materials and beat those up so the purpose is more explicitly spelled out and more clearly communicates to districts how tests are scored, the possible accessibility supports that are available to districts, and best practices for test administration. The department's been working with our teachers on improving the assessment system as a whole, and I want to thank those teachers and the Oregon Education Association for working with us to do that. The department is exploring the idea of lessening the dependence on one single test for accountability purposes so that we don't have what's perceived as a high-stakes test, more interim and more formative tests that are available to school districts. The department sees this flexibility as a new opportunity to really have a test for Oregon that makes sense for Oregon students instead of this more federal one-size-fits-all.
Any questions for these people? Thank you. And I did it in enjoy. No, that's, I appreciate your audit. It was a good read for me to see some of the things that, and it reaffirmed some things I thought, gave me some good things to think about in other places. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we'll go with David Crandall, Deb Meyer, Mary Van. Is that the right group?
My name is Mary, this is Deb, and David. And we're from—
And you need your last name, too.
Mary Thaman.
Thank you.
Deb Myers, David Crandall.
They'll have to do their own anyway,
oh,
so it's okay.
Okay, sorry. All right.
We're all virgins.
Yeah, very good, there you go.
We're from the Multnomah Democratic Party, and we're on the Education Caucus. And so we're here because we'd like to bring to your attention something that we're doing in the Education Caucus is that we've developed a resolution which is pending, which will end up here, which supports 351. And we brought the resolution here to read you part of it because, you know, it's a page. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to summarize why we're supporting 351. And, you know, the problem is that with the system, there's a lot that isn't working in the SBAC, and it's very controversial, and it's costing Oregon a lot of money. In fact, between 2010 and 2014, it's cost $414 million. Now, here's the thing. We would like to, we would support 351 because it's an audit to see what's working and what isn't. But we're also asking in the resolution for a moratorium. We understand that there's an memorandum of understanding that's coming up that will renew the SBAC sometime during the spring. Now, here's the thing. This would save you guys a lot of money since there's a $1 billion $1.7 billion shortfall. If you could, like, just put a moratorium on it till they get, you know, the whole system figured out, something better, in other words. So that's essentially what we'd like to encourage, those two things in supporting SB 351. So now, if you'd like to say something, I know that Deb wants to read the what we're actually asking for in the resolution.
Probably not the whole thing, and you can actually
I'm not going to read all the whereases because are a lot of them. But
and you need to give your name, too.
Okay.
It's your turn now.
All right. I'm Deb Mayer. Essentially, what we're supporting is all of the things that Senator Lupreg said in his opening. Basically, it's a resolution to support Senate Bill 351. And considering all of those things, therefore, be it that the Multnomah County Democratic Party resolves to support cost-effective assessments in Oregon public schools that benefit students, educators, and
schools.
Yeah,
she doesn't have to be that close to the mic.
Yeah.
Push it away, but you're good. Keep
going. Okay. Sorry. Cost-effective assessments that support students, educators, and schools by suspending the use of the statewide assessments developed by the multi-state consortium and postponing the renewal of any contracts or memoranda of understanding related to the use of statewide assessments, and by supporting Senate Bill 351 directing the Secretary of State to conduct a thorough cost-benefit audit related to the statewide summative assessments in Oregon public schools.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm David Crandall. I'm coming at this not only as part of the education group, but also from Oregon Save Our Schools and Angry Grandparents Against High-Stakes Testing, or AGAST. I'm also a grandfather. I'm also the founder and chief executive of a nonprofit that has worked for 45 years to help K-12 schools around the country, focusing on disadvantaged populations, handicapped, et cetera. As such, from those two perspectives, the higher order one, I have followed the federal initiatives for the last 40 years in their attempts to provide improved educational opportunities for disadvantaged populations, and I have seen them attempt to get more or less control and things ebb and flow. I've also seen at least 15 years during which testing has been attempted as a strategy to improve what's offered in classrooms. I've not seen any evidence that it's been effective. Regardless of whether that's cost-effective or educationally effective. And I think that's the trade-off that we're faced with today, and we have an opportunity here in Oregon to take a leadership position, since we've been allowed to by the outcome of this rather peculiar election of ours. But I want to also say a few words about how we got here and where I think we are not necessarily in a good place. We seem to have gotten to the current state of affairs because people came to believe, or at least not challenged, that corporations are the most important clients of the educational system, and therefore the purpose of education is to prepare students to work. Then they can contribute to the economy, and we have a problem. Corporations can't find enough qualified Americans to fill their positions, therefore the schools are failing the economy, because graduation isn't what they need to be. And therefore, so the logic goes, schools would be better if they were more like businesses. Businesses have improved their practices and their outcomes by using standards. Therefore, we need standards for schools. Standards should be developed by those who hire the graduates of the schools and colleges, i.e., the corporations. And that what's going to happen is once you have standards, you have to know how you're doing.
the whole standards process without running through every aspect of it was propelled by this seeming consensus that the outcomes of public education were unsatisfactory and needed to be refocused. The standards were the way to do it, and they started at the graduation level and worked their way backwards. One outcome of that that's less than desirable is they just started here and went all the way down, and they never stopped at, say, the third grade to say, is the best thing for little kids really a specific focus on literacy and mathematics in the primary grades? And you even have people like Mayor de Blasio in New York City applauding the fact they're going to press this academic focus into preschools and into Head Start. My grandson entered the public school system here in Portland 2 years ago, and the first thing he and fellow kindergartners were faced with was a test, the kindergarten readiness assessment. Well, he wasn't faced with it because he opted out, thank you very much. But school for little kids is not about taking a test, and learning how to read is not something that is done in a lockstep manner. So these little kids are being confronted with exercises, and especially disadvantaged kids. I live in the North Portland portion of the city. Those kids are coming to school, and some of them have never even seen a book until they hit school. Now in third grade, they're hitting a computer test on stuff that they have no grasp of. Forget about the language issues. So the standards are falling apart nationally. The testing consortia are collapsing. And Oregon has an opportunity to say, hey, hold it. How much is this costing us, and what are we getting? These tests and their results were originally designed as accountability measures, not as instructional improvement mechanisms. They do not provide data that is useful for improving what goes on in classrooms, because the kids can't, the teachers can't see what the kids can and can't do, nor can the parents. And I should say that in addition to all of that, the a study was done in New Jersey where by looking at three data points available from public information, they were able to predict with essentially dead-on accuracy the proficiency results of 80% of the middle schools in New Jersey by looking at.
So I'm going to ask everybody to go quicker because we've got a lot of other people out there.
So three variables available free gives you the same result as the millions of dollars spent on these tests. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Chair?
Just a comment, Ms. Chair. I thought it might be appropriate for me to acknowledge the fact that this may be the only time that I'm agreeing with the Democrat Party of Multnomah County.
Well, thank you. We'll take it.
Okay.
Thank you. The last two on this one are Kathleen Jeske and Rachel Ride. And
want us to come up together?
Oh, yeah, come on up together. And also Jared Mason Gear, who was going to talk about the 354. You can talk about either one. So come on up, Jared. And I think that takes care of everybody.
Did you say we could talk about either one? Because okay.
Yeah, you can talk about both of them at the same time.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm just
and
going
we do want to keep it fairly short because
sure.
We've got another couple of bills.
It's nice. Not very long. My name is Kathleen Jeske, and this is my 29th year teaching. And I currently teach at sixth grade in a dual language immersion program in Canby. And I'm here to speak in favor of both Senate Bill 351 and 354. Regarding the audit, we need an audit of the true costs of Smarter Balance Assessment because it drains so much time and money from our schools that are already struggling to provide adequate instructional minutes and reasonable class sizes. I submitted copies prior to this meeting to the senators of my school's testing schedule. My school, as I said, is a dual immersion school. We have 85% English language learners in an elementary school, grade K through 6. And you will see on that schedule that many classes that provide smaller groups for individualized instruction are canceled during testing, which lasts from February to May. and pulls teachers away from those small groups to administer the tests. And while ODE's draft ESSA plan appears to offer some relief from smarter balance at the high school level, it does nothing for elementary schools, where our entire schedule is disrupted by testing of one type or another for 4 months out of the 9 months that we're in school, 10 months. It's almost half the year. Smarter balance doesn't give us as teachers any information that we don't already have and already communicate to parents about student progress in reading and math. And while we may need to take the temperature of our system from time to time, smarter balance is more like surgery, and it's cosmetic surgery at that. The promise of proving that students are on track for college and career, there's zero evidence of that. It purports to provide more real-world problems, but it doesn't replicate in any way any work that students will ever be required to do in the real world outside of a standardized testing situation. How often in the real world is one required to perform a task or solve a problem or produce a piece of writing without the ability to consult any references or any other people? It's a weak imitation of what teachers assess all the time in the classroom, and there are far less invasive and less expensive instruments available for that temperature check. The idea of testing as accountability, as we all know, started with NCLB in 2001. I was teaching for quite some time before that. We have decades of data way before 2001 even that show clearly that poverty impacts student achievement. And my question about all of this is, when will equity of input be used as an accountability measure? When will anyone besides teachers and schools be asked to be accountable for gaps? And when will anyone be accountable for ensuring that students whose parents are not affluent enough to raise funds to make up for budget shortfalls have access to the programs and resources they need? Testing doesn't mean anything if we never provide communities what they need to succeed. It consumes financial and human resources that could change trajectories if test scores were not distracting from the real issue, which is inequity of programs in underserved communities due to the lack of adequate funding and income inequality. Additionally, this system never seems to question the assumption that students of color and English learners don't do as well on these tests because their learning is somehow inadequate. Tests have a really long history in the United States of being used to exclude certain groups of people from various things. And the system is culturally and linguistically biased. For example, many of my students, well, not my students because they're sixth graders, many students at my school who are not yet English proficient are required to take the English Language Arts assessment.
So did you,
and
did
I
you,
believe, I'm sorry.
Did you turn all this in already?
I did.
Okay, you don't need to read it because we're going to get that.
Okay.
And we have a lot of other people out here for two other bills.
So. Okay, so can I just finish this? I'm almost done. I think that violates the students' civil rights when we use those test results to make determinations about them and their schools and their futures. And I think we have to stop presenting information to parents that tries to convince them otherwise. I won't read the last paragraph, I guess. It's about the multi-state longitudinal data system, which I have a lot of concern about. And I also want to speak to 354. One of the concerns I heard raised was, well, some of the students that are only the people that are opting out are high-income families. And first of all, that's not true across the United States. There are multiple communities of color, low-income communities across the United States that are in flames over this testing because their schools are being closed because of this. At my school, what's been happening up until recently is my students' parents don't have equal access to information about the Smarter Balance test because my students' parents don't speak English. They don't have computers at home. Some have come and told me, wow, my kids really have a hard time taking a test on a computer because we don't have a computer at home. And so they're disadvantaged in that way. The parents are disadvantaged with access to the information when all it is put up on a website somewhere where if you don't have a computer, you don't speak English, the website's in English. How are you going to find that information? So I think this is all an equity issue, and I don't think that these tests are providing equity. I think they are taking equity away from our schools.
Thank you.
All right.
Fairly quickly. So.
Okay.
Two minutes would probably be best if you can do it in 2 minutes.
I'll try.
My name is Rachel Rich. I'm a retired teacher, and I've got a little slideshow here, but I have no idea how to turn that on.
So it should come up.
Okay. All right. Anyway, I'll just introduce myself until this whole thing works. I was involved in an NEA project where we were analyzing 1,000 different comments by teachers across the United States, and we were to back them up and promote smarter balance, but it didn't turn out that way. The thing that was most significant to me for this presentation is that standardized testing totaled $1.8 billion.
It's actually the other way around, 8.1.
Excuse me, thank you, 8.1. Thank you so much. And I was totally surprised, and that was in 2012 before Smarter Balanced and PARC. And I thought, well, okay, what can we compare this with? Because I had no idea from budgets. So I looked on the ODE site and came up with a compilation of 17 key services from the very youngest to the very eldest. And you can see talented and gifted is down. I met a student who is being tested up the wazoo.
We have all this too, right? You've turned this in?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll just do a quick version of it. Thank you. And then I decided to see what the expenses were for testing itself. I didn't get this out of the thin blue sky. I took it out of the AFT study of testing costs and also the Smarter Balance manual about what is required in order to test. And I came up with an increase of $86 million. Now, it needs to be clarified, that is not the total cost. It assumes the costs of administering OAKS, which is also a standardized computerized test. So this is merely on top of it. So non-test related professional development dropped $11 million. Basically, we're not supporting our students. These are the items that can be verified through contracts. Sometimes Rob Saxton varied between whether he was talking about annually or biennially, and what it boils down to, depending upon how you which contracts you accept as the final, is $359 to $616 million. Now, here's the part. We also need to add certain positions, and those are included in the information. But what I think is absolutely crucial is that we're not getting what we want for our money. The ODE exhibit, The Right Trajectory, shows that Smarter Balance doesn't shed light on low to mid performers, but only on mid to high. And there are 2 to 3 times as many difficult questions as on previous standardized tests, so you can't compare apples with apples. And it raises the expectations by one entire level. So we are having a lot of moving parts at one time. And it rates the suitability of items, get this, for well-served kids in an excellent classroom who are native speakers, who, let's see, what else, are not disadvantaged and who are not disabled. And I thought that was frankly hilarious. And 80% of the teachers who did the evaluation were in the upper socioeconomic group for their students. So this unprecedented leap obviously doesn't help teaching or learning.
Thank you very much. Yeah. And I do appreciate all the other stuff because we had a conversation and we'll continue to do that. So, Jared.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Jared Mason, here representing the Oregon Education Association and our 44,000 educators around the state. Testifying in support of SB 354, we worked with Senator Frederick to bring this bill forward and appreciate his advocacy in this realm. I guess I wanted to just quickly add some context that I think is important just sort of by way of reminder. In 2015, the legislature passed Senate Bill 2683, which created, sort of codified the new pathwork, which is a collaboration between the Oregon Education Association, the Governor's Office, Chief Education Office, and the Department of Education to set Oregon on a new path of summative assessment. And you have received updates at different points through the interim on the progress of that work, which will ultimately move us away from Smarter Balance into a system of assessment that works for Oregon students. And so I wanted to just reassure you, we believe that that progress is moving forward, and we feel good about the work that's being done there. Simultaneously, in 2015, the legislature passed House Bill 2655, which was the summative assessment opt-out bill, which we believe addressed some really significant problems around the equity of notification to students and parents, dealing with some of the limitations that we think were really problematic around under which circumstances students could or could not opt out of summative summative assessments. in the implementation of that bill, we thought that was a huge victory, and there were a lot of upsides to that. But in the implementation, we noticed that there were some ambiguities in the legislative language that allowed for some unclear noticing to families, and then also to some circumstances where we've been hearing from parents and from educators around the state, instances of various types of pressuring from administrators of students to not opt out, instances where opt-out forms were not received by administrators because they weren't dropped off in person, or finding various little loopholes that prevented them from honoring opt-outs. So that's why SB 354 was brought forward, to clarify that language, and we believe ensure that the intent of 2655 is carried out, and we would urge your support.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There is no one else on our list to speak, so we are going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 351 and 354, and we're going to move to Senate Bill 280. So we'll have a short statement from our administrator, and then we'll have our people come on up. You can come on up if you want right now.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 280 appropriates an unspecified amount of money to the Department of Education for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2017 for the purpose of developing academic content standards for Oregon Studies and supporting teacher training and classroom instruction in Oregon Studies. The bill declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
You get to start. Whoever wants to start.
Go ahead, Joyce. Good afternoon. I'm Joyce Liu, and I'm a member of the Portland Chinese community, and I'm here today to read the written testimony of Helen L. Ying, one of our community leaders who is not able to be here today, but I know that she's here in spirit and in heart, and probably looking over my shoulders. She writes, "Dear Mr. Chairman Roblin and members of the Senate Committee on Education, my name is Helen Ying. I live in Portland and serve as the National Vice President of Membership for the Chinese American Citizens Alliance National Lodge and a board member of the Portland Lodge. First and foremost, I want to thank you on behalf of the Portland Lodge for making this hearing possible for Senate Bill 280. 3 years ago, a team representing our lodge came before you at the invitation of then Committee Chair Senator Haas to present why it is important to include the Chinese American history in the U.S. history curriculum. Today, we are back with an expanded and more inclusive ask. Oregon social studies teaching in school has been legislatively mandated to increase the inclusion of history of all Oregonians in its curricula for each grade. But the updated materials, training of faculty, and other resources have not been adequately funded by the legislature to accomplish this goal. Having been educated in Oregon and being an educator in Oregon, it was not until 2009 that I learned about the history of Chinese Americans and how it related to me personally. As with the history of many in the communities of color, the Chinese American history has largely been omitted in the Oregon social studies teaching. Since then, I have embarked on a journey to educate others about the Chinese American history, including participating in the efforts of supporting the work of getting Congress to pass resolutions of apology for the Chinese Exclusion Act and the ensuing issues, meeting with Oregon legislators and Oregon Department of Staff in the work of including Chinese American history in Oregon studies, and traveling around Oregon, sharing about Chinese American history in the various locales. Along the way, we learned that many in the communities of color share the same sentiments in the quest of inclusive history education in Oregon. We also learned that lack of funding from the legislature to the Oregon Department of Education and school districts to support curriculum development and professional development has significantly slowed the implementation of the law, Senate Bill 739. The needle on the dial of implementation is slight. The only shift at the Oregon Department of Education level is a website that is sparsely populated with resources. Each graduating class represents thousands of youthful Oregonians who need this inclusive education to be successful in today's world, valuing the contributions of all Oregonians in their lives and future workplaces. Each passing year without the funds to implement is opportunity lost for these growing minds. This legislation would provide the necessary funding to achieve the goals and purposes of Senate Bill 739 to be inclusive of the history of all Oregonians in the Oregonian classrooms. The earmarked funding would be made available to enable the Oregon Department of Education to provide staffing and resources in working with school districts to create a systematic plan for professional development and curriculum development for inclusive lessons of the history and contribution of all Oregonians. Thank you very much for your support in making history studies in Oregon to include all Oregonians a reality. And it's signed Ellen L. Yang.
Thank you very much.
Chairman.
And you don't have to be very close. It'll pick it up, so you're
Chairman
good.
Chairman Roblin and committee members. My name is Betty Jean Lee. I was born and raised here in Portland, Oregon, nearly 83 years ago, and serve as regional executive director for the National Chinese American Citizens Alliance and secretary of the Portland Lodge. I attended Grant High School and University of Oregon in the late 40s and early 50s. My husband and I raised three children who also attended school in Oregon. Sadly, the curriculum in the schools did not teach much history of people of color, especially Chinese Americans. Some 20 years ago, I took my granddaughter to an exhibit in Portland from the Smithsonian Institute. It was showing the public history of the Pacific Northwest, particularly, but part of the western part of the United States. After going through the exhibit, I asked my granddaughter, who was around 10 or 11 at the time, what was missing in that exhibit. And of course, she didn't know. And I asked her, who built the railroad? It was missing in the exhibit. How could this happen? Is this a piece of history we want recorded? How could it be forgotten? Senate Bill 280 is seeking funding for Oregon social studies to be inclusive of all Oregonians. Together we can ensure that Oregon students learn about the history and incredible contributions of Chinese Americans and communities of color whose stories seldom make it to the history books. The CACA National was established in 1895. Our Portland Lodge is 96 years old and is one of the 18 lodges in the United States. Our local lodge focuses on three areas of service: youth scholarship awards, interscholastic basketball, Asian American Youth Leadership Conference in high schools for high school students, civic engagement and education on historic and current civil rights, community service for the underserved seniors and families through partnership with the Asian Health and Service Center. Passing this bill will certainly help us in building a better community along with passing history to the next generation. We thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Kent Lee. I'm the president of the Portland chapter of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. I'm a third generation Chinese American and was educated through the Portland public school system. My history teachers said that our country is a melting pot of cultures, and this is what helped our country to be a great country. And that was it, that's all I learned. I don't recall learning any history of the different ethnic groups in their history in our country. I learned about the Chinese history in this country from my parents and grandparents. I also have a Japanese uncle whose family was placed in an internment camp during World War II. He told me that the living conditions were poor, and one of his brothers fell ill and died in that camp because of the poor medical care. I've heard of the stories from Japanese Americans who willingly joined and served in the U.S. military during World War II to prove that they were good American citizens willing to die for our country. Can you imagine what it's like to fight for a country that holds your family in an internment camp? And I don't think that was unique to the Japanese community. I suspect members of the German-American and Italian-American communities suffered too. Learning about the history of the various ethnic people in our country will help to stimulate cultural sensitivity, and in our and if our citizens aren't aware of the history, we risk repeating the mistakes of the past. We can read, watch, and listen to the national news of today and wonder if history will repeat itself. So please support Senate Bill 280 to help provide the resources needed to train our educators and thus our students who will become the future leaders of our state and country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Dana Buell, Aaron Shaw, Sarah Siegel, and Joan. I'm going to get Joan's last name totally Kavik. Wrong. Kavik? Okay. We need, may need one more chair up there, so I think. Okay. Perfect. Thank you. And whoever wants to start first, unless the person wants to start, second wants to start first. Okay, go for it.
Since I'm probably the most nervous.
And you don't need to be too close to the microphone.
Right.
It'll pick it up.
Okay, good afternoon, Senator Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Erica Wong of the Chinese American Citizens Alliance. I'll be reading Sarah Siegel's statement of the Orient Council for Social Studies. Sarah says, my name is Sarah Siegel, and I'm writing this letter of testimony on behalf of the Orient Council for the Social Studies in support of Senate Bill 280. I was a 2016 Oregon Council for the Social Studies president and have been a member of the board since 2012. The Oregon Council for the Social Studies, or OCSS, is a statewide organization of social study educators who collaborate and support best practices of history teaching and learning. What is best for kids? Senate Bill 280 is best for kids. Now, perhaps more than ever, purposeful, accurate, and comprehensive social studies teaching and learning is imperative. However, in order to provide students with meaningful learning, educators must have access to thoughtfully designed curriculum resources and professional development opportunities for teaching inclusive Oregon history. Designating funds for developing inclusive Oregon history curriculum and professional development is essential for the student success in the classroom, community, and as global citizens. Beyond my OCSS membership, I am additionally personally and professionally vested in the potentially incredible outcomes that will come with funding Senate Bill 280. Okay, as a teacher at Hood River Middle School, my students learn, about our community's horrific actions against Japanese Americans during World War II and took informed action to honor Minoru Yasui. Hood River Middle School students created a video letter asking President Obama to honor Minoru Yasui with the Presidential Medal of Freedom Award in 2015, and then testified twice during the 2016 Oregon legislative session in support of permanent declaration of March 28th as Minoru Yasui Day. Comprehensive learning is essential to growing knowledgeable and engaged students who become adult citizens. Funding Senate Bill 280 will result in the creation of inclusive, high-quality curriculums and professional development opportunities for best practices in Oregon history teaching and learning for all grades and in every classroom. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you want to say anything on your own?
Well, as a native Portlander, and I thoroughly enjoyed my education through public school system, but unfortunately, I didn't learn about the minority groups and the contributions to the state until way past education age. So I firmly support this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee. My name is Dana Buell. I live in Portland. I'm a public school parent in support of Senate Bill 280. I'm white. I've lived my life with unearned, largely unexamined, and unconscious advantages because I'm white. My education supported racial hierarchy. It centered the culture and history of my European American predecessors. It reduced ethnicities to broad racial categories. It minimized or omitted the perspectives of non-white people. and all the while said that everyone should be treated the same. Like it or not, I've absorbed deep racial bias for the ways and histories of my people as the right ways. Non-white cultures and histories are other, not integral to the fabric of our nation's history. As an adult committed to racial equity, I see how my schooling damaged me. It ill-prepared me to examine issues of power and privilege connected to race, issues vital to civic engagement. It stunted my ability to engage with, learn from, and collaborate with people outside of my racial group, and it hindered my ability to talk with other white people about race, power, and privilege. My white fifth grade daughter attends a school committed to racial equity. Even so, her schooling has reinforced a view of white is right. Most of her teachers are white like her. The third grade Portland History musical told the story of white explorers, leaders, businessmen, builders, innovators. Non-white populations were side stories, tales of the weak and dominated. Their contributions seen as exceptional, not part of the fabric of history. These are damaging messages of white supremacy. I hear voices from the 38% of Oregon school students who are not white. I hear pain, internalized negative messages about themselves and their cultures. I hear frustration and sense of loss. I hear how our school system excludes and marginalizes their histories and their voices. All students should learn that their racial and ethnic histories are vital to the Oregon we are today. It's our responsibility to develop competent, confident, and collaborative students, and I want this for my daughter. Please support Senate Bill 280 to fund educators to write and teach curricula that reflect the diverse Oregon that makes us who we are. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dear Chair Roblin and the Senate and the members of the Senate Committee on Education, my name is Aaron Shaw, and I am a high school junior at Jesuit High School. I understand the passing of this bill will not help my specific private institution, but I would love to help make history for the public schools in Oregon. In the entire lifespan of our universe, there has been no greater story than the history of the human race. We learn from this story, we can laugh about it, we can have conversations about it, but most of all, we take pride in it. America prides itself for being a heroic country, charging into battles in other countries like Korea, Vietnam, and Afghanistan in order to be the knight in shining armor. Although we can promote America's history, minorities often see this and feel excluded. We ask, where are we in all of this heroism? Are we not present at all? Especially for younger students, if they are not taught about their culture and heritage in school, they will have a hard time learning about it at their busy homes. From grades 1 through 8, before I transitioned to a private school curriculum, I underwent the public school history curriculum. I did learn a lot. I learned about how British settlers established colonies, how the Corps of Discovery mapped the road to the Pacific, and how America became the most powerful nation following World War II. I came to respect Western culture for its successes. However, the only time the Asian race was mentioned was during a very brief time during discussing immigrants in the 19th century. Learning of this and nothing else about our history made me feel like just that, foreigners in the land we now call our home. In the modern era that we live in, minorities have had their pride and culture taken away from them. An inclusive history curriculum, which Senate Bill 280 endeavors to accomplish, will provide members of minorities knowledge about their own culture, and knowledge is power. We will be able to stand up for who we are, reaching closer to a society with racial equality. My hope is for my 11-year-old sister to grow up with a diverse and empowering history curriculum so she can be proud of who she was born as. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon,
and
Chair
you don't
Roblin.
Have to get close. You can sit
and
back.
Members of the Education Committee. My name is Gloria Lee, and I have submitted my testimony online. I will not be reading that. Instead, today I'll be reading the testimony of Joan Kavicka, who has her MA and MS in education, in social studies in particular. Rest assured that I will shorten her long testimony.
And make sure it gets submitted as well. You can submit that afterwards. It'll
the long, it yeah. is submitted.
Oh, perfect.
It's online. It's okay. Very long, if any of you, and I know that yeah. probably looking at me with horror because it's about okay. 8 pages, but I have an excerpt.
Okay.
I know Joan personally, and I know where her heart is, so I want to read what her testimony is because she couldn't be with us. She is an award-winning social studies teacher in the Portland Public School classroom for over 30 years. She's the former education director of the Lansu Chinese Garden in Portland, and she's an educator consultant with the Portland Japanese Garden and a published global studies curriculum developer. Joan can speak with certainty when she teaches that our past is forever with us. Yet the past can be so deeply buried as to render it dead and gone for those who tread in its indelible footsteps. Our great democracy is grounded in discourse, silenced voices, however diverse, only assure that our understanding, application, and exercise of democratic justice remains incomplete. Joan is hopeful that with the adoption of Senate Bill 280, appropriate money will finally be authorized for purposes of developing academic standards and materials to support teacher training and classroom instruction as stipulated in Senate Bill 739, signed into Oregon law in August of 2013. We are in 2017. Senate Bill 280 will ensure that Oregon's full history be inclusive of the true diversity of its people, cultures, accomplishments, and struggles under the framework of Oregon Studies. Senate Bill 280 will have profound results on the teaching of Oregon's inclusive history. However, the long shadows of the history of exclusion are also of vital importance in imparting to our students a deep understanding of how moments of darkness in our past can shed light on our collective present and imagined future. Senate Bill 280 curriculum can allow students to investigate Oregon's stories of hope, promise, exclusion, inclusion, struggle, success, creativity, and community. Please indulge Joan with what she considers a teachable moment to demonstrate the need for Senate Bill 280 to write a more complete Oregon story, inclusive of diverse perspectives that often remain loudly silent in our classrooms. And following that, she has some pages of curriculum that could be developed because she is in a superb social studies teacher in the Portland Public School System. And I can take any questions on my own testimony or any questions on Joan's, but thank you very much for this opportunity. And let's just move this bill forward.
Thank you. Is there any conversation or questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we have one more group. Let's see. Is it Juana Loom and Stephen Yang? Is that the only two that are left? Well, at least Stephen, come on up. Is there anyone else that was going to speak that hasn't had a chance? You're welcome to come up now.
Okay.
I know Stephen would be acceptable to work with. I know that he feels uncomfortable being all by himself. He's such a shy person.
Bashful.
Yeah, that's true.
Good afternoon, Chair Robin and member of the committee. My name is Stephen Yang. I'm the commissioner of Asian Pacific Islander Affairs. Today, I'm representing the advocacy committee. Committees consist of committees of Black and Hispanic and women, also Asian affair. To show the support of SB 280, the letter of support is submitted by our office already. So, for you guys to read, then I'll save the valuable time for you. Thank you. Any question?
Any questions for Stephen? I guess I would make a comment. It used to be made of this committee that we were all older white males. But you can see there's not a lot of diversity up here. But there's a lot of people who have diverse thoughts up here. And I think there is a feeling amongst many of us that this the curriculum that we've had is missing the point with regard to making sure that we really understand who we are as Oregonians. You know, we passed a bill earlier and sent it on about Native American studies. We have done some things with regard to Native Americans and mascots to make it the tribes get to decide whether or not and how, as long as education is taught about their particular tribe in their particular area, if they want to have a mascot. And that's been moving along in a I think, a pretty productive way with the tribal people of the local area making decisions about how they're represented in their communities. So I hope we continue to do that, and I hope that as you work with your Asian communities and all of these other communities, that you encourage them to become, to sit up here. We need to get as much diversity in the legislature as we can. We had a long history of not having that many women. We're getting more, and they're and they not on our committee, but we're getting more. That voice has been a powerful one on this committee. We talk about it regularly. So I mean, I think it works best when we have people who can represent each of those committees as themselves. And we know in education that when those students out there see themselves in the teacher, it makes a difference. So we'll continue to work on those kinds of things.
May I ask a few more sentences?
Yes, please.
So about 12 years ago, Senator Winter have passed a law about the education, and nothing happened till 2014, another bill passed, but there was no funding for that bill. So OCAPIA is in charge of helping the ODE to run this legislature, but didn't work because there's not money in it all. So I hope this bill passed the education committee and then next go to the Ways and Means. We can get some funding to move this bill forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there any other person who was sitting out there and now decided they really wanted to say something? Come on up. Yes, you can, because I asked you to.
Okay.
Come on up.
Thank you.
But do make sure you give your name first so we know who you are.
Thank you. My name is Eileen Hawes. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and thank you, Senator Roblin, and the committee for hearing our testimony. I want to say that I'm a mother of a Portland public school student, an eighth grader. He is a biracial child, African-American boy, and it's super important to me that Oregon's history curriculum include a really diverse representation of who our Oregonians are and who our people are here in the state. All the communities that we need to learn from and recognize the leadership from, the creativity, the resilience of all Oregonians include our Chinese American community, our Native American communities, our African American communities, et cetera. Our minority communities and our immigrant communities all contribute tremendously to who we are as a state. And I want my son to go into high school knowing that he's going to see himself represented in our Oregon history and his friends and his peers as well. And I thank you for letting me speak. I'm a little nervous, but I really wanted to say something.
Thank you for taking the opportunity. Keep
and I did again. Submit something earlier for okay. in writing, so thank you.
Thank you. I'll try one more time. Is there anybody else who's sitting out there who didn't get a chance to say what they would like to say to our committee? I don't see anyone else jumping up. I see somebody looking this way to make sure I wasn't calling on them, but I don't see anybody coming up. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 280. We're going to carry over Senate Bill 747. Postpone. Senate Bill 747. And we have a couple work sessions. So we're going to open a work session. If I had some students here, I'd explain to them what we were doing and why. But we don't have a lot of little kids here. So we're going to go with Senate Bill 183. We're going to open a work session. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill. And then we'll go from there and have some pictures. So this is the bill we heard a week or so ago.
Several
weeks ago.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 183 establishes the early indicator and intervention system and delineates program requirements, goals, and implementation guidelines. It establishes the graduation equity program and directs the Oregon Department of Education in coordination with the Chief Education Office to distribute monies to school districts, education service districts, nonprofit organizations, post-secondary institutions, or tribes. It establishes the graduation equity account in the state treasury, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2017.
Yes.
Mr. Can I just clarify? This is the high school graduation, not the non-normative sexual behavior strike force?
Correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes. This one came from the department earlier through some other kinds of things. And it's going to Ways and Means, and it has a price tag. And so we're going to have to work through that as we move forward. But I want to give it an opportunity to go there. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Concerns, it's kind of vague.
It is.
Okay. So there's two concerns from my perspective is that we are not the ones establishing the program. We're telling somebody else to. That's problematic for me. And my other concern was the potential, because it is so vague, that meat might be put on the bones down in Ways and Means, which is also very problematic for me. I would prefer that we put some more structure on it before we send it, but, you know, it's your call.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I will keep in touch with you as it moves towards the Ways and Means, because I want to get it there to see if there's any realistic appraisal of costs and other kinds of things. But thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
From that perspective, we do have the ability to loan bills to other committees.
That's true as well.
And so you could, for example, loan it to Ways and Means to get some numbers on it, and then we could deal with structure.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the possibility.
I do appreciate that. Thank you. So, with that, do you want to make the motion, or you want me to have?
Would it be appropriate to suggest, instead of referring it to Joint Ways and Means, to quote loan it? I'm not familiar with the terminology, I don't know how to.
We don't make loans. I know what he's saying.
No, but we have done that before with bills. But you know, I'm just saying
we don't have a way to do that actually.
So we should tell Senator Cruz he doesn't know what he's talking about.
We should tell Senator Cruz that there may have been arrangements made at different times that I don't know about, that I don't know of any way to do that. So.
Okay, if there's no technical way of doing that, which I thought sounded like a legitimate idea because of its vagueness, I'll just make the motion for discussion to move Senate Bill 183 with the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Lithcomb moves Senate Bill 183 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Okay, I think I got it all there. Anyway, discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no, not that I don't think it's a bad idea, but just as a signal that I think
we should look at it more closely.
That's problematic what might happen.
Okay. That's fair.
Senator Roblin?
Yes.
The agenda says it's a subsequent referral to general government accountability. Did that get lifted?
Oh, thank you.
No, that's the
That's not the one. Yes. Go ahead.
That's the other bill.
That's the other bill.
No.
If we did, we'll have
to. We're on 183. Three is Ways and Means.
Oh, it's right under 183.
Right.
It does say that.
Oh, it's on top. It's aligned with the bill number, not underneath.
421 is the one that's going to general government?
Okay. It was going to go to general government, but we did get an agreement to move it off of that one.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Yes. We'll be more carefully.
That was almost a nice catch, Mark.
Okay. Pardon? Right. Yeah. It's above it, not below it, so. Thank you for that. Any other discussion?
I'll join Senator Cruz in my hesitancy because of the vagueness of this bill.
Thank you. We better take a roll call vote.
Senator Belser?
Yes.
Senator Haas?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Vice Chair Lincoln?
No.
Aye. So the bill passes and is on its way to Ways and Means, and I will take those considerations when it gets there to make sure I have conversations with people. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one more point.
I should have talked about this earlier.
But if we're considering substantive changes down there, it is possible to send the bill back to committee for that to happen.
That is true.
Okay.
That would be a loan.
So we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 183. 3. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 421. And we need a couple motions here because this bill...
It's all one motion.
Oh, it's all one motion? Okay, so we'll hear the motion. But this bill did have subsequent referrals to a couple other places, and I just wanted to be fairly clear with people because it's rare that we don't have a hearing before we have a bill move. But this bill, there's a request to use the relating clause in Ways and Means to have a conversation about things that have to do with, what's it called? Cost containment. And so it's going to Ways and Means just to be used for cost containment. It's not going to be using the language of this bill. And I like to be upfront about why and what's happening.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, but that's another thing.
I know.
Okay, that we're...
I mean,
if there's specific directions we want to go, that should be the issue of the policy committee to establish those directions and then send the bill to Ways and Means to have it funded. That's my objection.
Okay. I understand that part, too. And I appreciate it, actually.
Yeah.
I just think that we have this particular session, we're doing a lot of things with both sides of the aisle to try to figure out how do we do cost containment, how do we do other kinds of things, and sometimes the bills are needed for that kind of stuff.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm not objecting to intent or...
I know.
I'm just objecting to process. And,
gotcha.
And it's frustrated me for 20 years that we send bills to Ways and Means and they do substantive changes to them, and that's... they're supposed to do budget.
Yep. Okay.
I've got this language right here. Let's see if I get it. Sorry. Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 421 without recommendation as to its passage, but with the request that the sub-referral to the Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability be rescinded and it be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Okay.
You did that well.
I agree.
Lisa typed it up for me.
Senator Lithicum moves that Senate Bill 421 without recommendation as to passage, but with the request that the sub-referral to the Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability be rescinded and be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. And we've talked with everybody that needs to at the president's office to make sure this is okay. So that's where we're at.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I will object on right. principle as I did on the last one. So.
And I appreciate that comment as well. So, any further discussion? Seeing none, we might as well do a roll call again. We're getting used to that. So we'll do a roll call vote.
Senator Nelson?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes.
Senator Cruz? No.
Vice Chair Lincoln?
Yes.
Chair Robin?
Yes. Bill passes and it's on its way to Ways and Means. So, any other conversation and stuff? And I do want to say that I actually, in large part, agree with the ongoing conversation that Senator Cruz is making about. The Ways and Means process is for Ways and Means, which is money, as opposed to policy. I think there are times when that happens. I don't want them to get carried away doing it too often, and so I will watch that as well, because I agree with that sentiment. So, any other conversations for today? If not, we're going to close the Senate Education Committee. Thank you all for being here. For being here. Close the Senate Education Committee. Thank you all.